Hello and welcome to No Helmet Required, the original Cedar Cove podcast, in which I, Auntie Karen, and my two friends, Auntie Sarah and Uncle Brian, provide a play-by-play of each and every episode of the original Hallmark dramatic series, Cedar Cove. Auntie Sarah, Uncle Brian, would you like to introduce yourselves?
Sure. My name is Auntie Sarah, and my favorite Jerry is Jerry Blank from Strangers with Candy.
Nice. I love that show.
I love that Jerry.
Yeah.
Will you tell us, like, one thing about that Jerry, so that those of us who are not familiar with the character...
Jerry Blank is an adult woman who is going through a renaissance. And as she likes to say, I was a user, a boozer, and a loser. But so she decides to go back to high school.
Yeah, she has to go back and finish her high school degree, but she's like 45 or something.
And like a hardened drug addict slash like former prostitute slash like convict.
What a great Jerry.
She's awesome.
Yeah.
She's so crazy.
Daddy! Yeah. And dear listener, we had this idea to list our favorite Jerry in honor of the character, Jack's ex-wife, Jerry, whom we're all enjoying very much.
Yes, crazy Jerry. Enjoying her, yeah. Yes. Yeah. So I'm Uncle Brian, and the first favorite Jerry of mine that came to mind is the late, unfortunately, character actor Jerry Orbach, known for work on Law and Order, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But also he was on everything, right?
Yeah.
Like guest appearances on Murder, She Wrote, and I see that every so often. Golden Girls, he played several episodes on Golden Girls.
Isn't Jerry Orbach the guy who gave his eyes...
Oh, no.
Who donated his eyes to science?
What?
Or not, we gotta look this up later. Wasn't he the man who donated his eyes as like an organ donation when he died?
I don't know. That would be
gentle and wonderful.
Generous. Like, yeah. I think Jerry Orbach probably was.
Well, we'll look it up later.
And in his honor, you know how Ben and Jerry's ice cream makes Cherry Garcia, right?
Yeah.
When I made cherry ice cream with dark chocolate chips in it, I called my version Cherry Orbach.
Oh!
In tribute, in honor.
So creepy, rude, and wonderful.
Jerry Orbach.
Oh! Wow.
Yeah.
Cherry
Uncle Brian. I love that story. That's the best.
That's very sweet.
Well, I'm Auntie Karen, and I actually have a real-life favorite Jerry.
Oh.
I had a very sweet boyfriend in high school and college.
That's right.
His name was Jerry. And
Is he the one who loved Depeche Mode?
Yes! Yes. Well, he did, but I had a boyfriend before that who really loved Depeche Mode.
Okay.
He was the one that painted the dead roses.
Oh, because we talked about him.
Yeah. Yeah, we were boyfriend and girlfriend for 4 years.
And Jerry's a teacher now, right?
I think he's a teacher now. You're probably not listening, Jerry, but if you are, you're my favorite Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Jerry.
Aww.
So this week, we'll walk you through our synopsis of Season 2, Episode 11.
Whoa, we're getting there.
All right.
We're getting there.
We are. We're approaching the end. Strap in. Okay, so based on the episode title...
Yeah.
Stand and deliver.
Oh my God!
Yes. You can be forgiven, dear listener, for wondering if Judge Olivia Lockhart has retired from the bench to become an inspirational high school math teacher in East LA. But she hasn't. And there are no cameos by Edward James Olmos or Lou Diamond Phillips in this episode either.
That's too bad.
So I don't know what to tell you.
I like both of those.
I do too.
They should also be Jerry's.
I agree. Honorary Jerry's. Jerry James Olmos.
Jerry Diamond Phillips.
Jerry Diamond Phillips.
That's perfect.
I guess the writers just picked the episode title out of the same bag of Scrabble tiles. They've been using to write much of the dialogue in the second half of the season. Alright, so if we don't have any inspiration, what does this episode offer us?
Oh, God.
It offers us dread.
No.
Dread, dear listener. The dread of our own fallen world intruding into the idealized world of Cedar Cove.
Oh, shit.
Of bad things happening to people,
some
of whom deserve it, and some of whom do not.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Things fall apart, dear listener. The center cannot hold.
Oh, my God.
So here's our E story.
Uncle Brian, you're too good for us.
No, stop.
You are, no one deserves you. No, you are stop. Too good for all of us.
Oh, you're too kind. I think
hold.
We all deserve each other. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Our E story focuses on Peggy and her terror at the return of her stalker, Colin McFadden, to Cedar Cove. I say stalker, but there's clearly something more than that here, right?
Yeah.
Like, we don't have the full story, but there's the connotation of sexual violence in this plot,
right?
Oh, for
sure.
Yeah. No question. We open with Peggy and Roy Sideburn's PI meeting at the captain's galley, continuing their pattern of holding private meetings in public places.
So stupid.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Roy asks Peggy for the full story about Colin and what he did to her. Peggy, tearful, tells him to forget the whole thing.
Forget all of it.
Yeah. Now
new
we
program.
See. Right. Now we see Bob at Moon's, smiling jovially. He tells Moon that he's happy about the return of a good friend, and Colin appears behind him. Moon clearly knows Colin, and looks both unimpressed and upset.
Oh.
Bob asks Moon to convince Colin to stay in Cedar Cove this time, and then steps away. I don't know, bathroom or something. Colin tries to banter with Moon, but Moon quotes Shakespeare. Hi, Auntie Cheryl. Moon says, "What is past is prologue," and explains that he's not happy to see Colin because past behavior predicts future behavior. Colin pretends not to understand, but Moon's not having it. "I think you know that I know," he says. Bob returns to the counter and notices the awkwardness. Colin offers a cover story that he and Moon had a falling out over a woman. Bob asks who, all chummy-like, and Colin says
boy.
He'll never kiss and tell, and Moon gives him a murderous look.
Oh, boy.
That was a really good Moon impression.
Thanks! I'd like to say I was practicing, but I wasn't. Later, Peggy is gardening at the Time and Tide. Colin surprises her, and she's clearly terrified. He has brought her flowers, and he fondly recalls how many years it's been. "You're still a beautiful woman," he says.
Ugh.
Ugh. Then he says that what happened between them will stay between them. Bob doesn't need to know. And he says that it was as much his fault as it was hers.
What?
Yeah. She is shaking with fury but seems paralyzed. But then Moon shows up, interrupting them, clearly on purpose. Colin leaves. Peggy is beside herself. Later, Bob is meeting with Roy Sideburn's PI. He says he wants to know who is sending Peggy flowers because he noticed that this has made Peggy jumpy and nervous. He's worried. Roy Sideburn's PI says he'll call him tomorrow.
What a big dummy he's being right now.
Yeah. And that's where we leave that story. In terms of our discussion, I suppose we could talk about what the PI code of ethics will allow Roy Sideburns to tell Bob in this situation. But I'm more interested in speculating about how Moon and Peggy could conspire to murder Colin and whether they could get away with it. I'm serious. If Colin does not end up dead at the end of this whole plot, I'm going to be very unsatisfied. But maybe we'll put a pin in that and return to it later.
I think that's a good idea. So, like, there's all this buildup, and then that's all we get. Like, this storyline is moving really slowly.
Glacially, right?
A glacial pace.
Yeah.
I can't believe they're forcing us to wait the entire season to figure out what the hell's going
on
with those two.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. Ugh, terrible. All right, D story. You'll recall, aunties, that Eric's life has been looking up since he started working for fecal artist Warren Saget. New house, new clothes, shorter bangs.
Oh, thank God. Those bangs. Ew, so gross.
But as Biggie memorably put it, mo' money, mo' problems. And this is where we find Eric, caught between two women who don't really want to sleep with him, and on the fast track to prison for financial crimes he didn't commit and wouldn't even understand.
True.
Yeah.
So true.
Speaking of prison, we open Eric's story with Warren, sitting alone at his desk, looking worried as he reads an article about an FBI sting. As he reads, his cell rings, and the perp named in the headline, Dick Turnbull, shows up on Warren's caller ID.
Oh, yeah. Jesus.
Dun, dun, dun.
Dick Turnbull.
What a name!
Yeah.
Oh, you know he's bad news.
Yeah. Put a pin in this for about 5 minutes. But now back to Eric. We open with Eric taking a huffy Shelly back to the dock. He thinks she's leaving because of Rebecca, Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he apologizes for everything. He wants to stay with her. No. But Shelley says, Adele complicates us. Beat. We'll always be Adele's parents. Which I guess is just one more attempt by Shelley to break up with him without saying she's breaking up with him.
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever. Moments later, an angry-browed Eric storms into Moons and confronts Rebecca.
I love when he gets his grouch Muppet eyebrow.
Our Muppet is Muppet angry. Yes, it's true.
Totally.
Yes. He gives her back her silky camisole.
Damn, gross. Here, I'm done with this.
And he says...
Stop with this. Stop. Oh, yuck. I'm sorry. I used it too many times and I don't know how to wash it.
No.
Is this a synthetic material?
I mean, it's not the hand wash. Does that mean you wash your hands and then you touch it? I mean...
I don't know the difference between rayon and silk. Is this a poly blend? I'm done with it.
It was not a tasteful camisole. I mean, we haven't really talked about it.
Loud,
it had like a zebra orange print or something.
Gross.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Something.
It was trashy. So he essentially throws the silky camisole back at her and says, Shelley broke up with me because of us. Rebecca reasonably replies, there is no us. Then Eric accuses her of sabotage by leaving the camisole behind. Sabotage.
I just thought of the Rage Against the Machine song.
No, Beastie Boys.
Oh, fuck.
It's sabotage! That's what I thought of, too.
Yeah. Well, he accuses her of sabotage. Why was this in my bed? He asks. Of course, the appropriate answer to this is because you don't change your sheets regularly, you moron. Like,
right, yeah.
You didn't notice?
It's so gross.
Like, how many days did you sleep with that just sort of around your ankle?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, so stupid.
So gross.
But Rebecca takes a more psychological tack. She says he's just angry because he has realized that he and Shelley have nothing in common other than Adele.
Duh.
This is true.
Yeah.
She tells him to stop blaming everyone else. He gets a look like a very angry 5-year-old, or like a Muppet. I can't do anything but laugh when this actor tries to play angry. Like, it's just comical.
Or when he tries to do anything, really.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's bad.
This is a dummy.
Finally, Eric says, I think I'm sorry I ever met you. And Rebecca says this is the only true thing he has said today.
Well,
yeah.
Eric reports to work. But Warren isn't there. Instead, there's some guy just wandering around in Warren's office. Eric recognizes him as Dick Turnbull. Warren's partner. Where have we heard that name before? Dick is not a warm and cuddly man. He has an air of menace, and he tells Eric to get him a coffee. Eric bristles and says, I'm one of Warren's associates. But Dick doesn't care. He says, not if you don't get me that coffee. Eric tries to tell Dick that he shouldn't be in Warren's office, but Dick just says, get me that coffee. Later, Warren arrives at work. Dick is sitting in Warren's chair with his feet on Warren's desk. He asks Warren why all their business partners are getting pinched by the FBI. Dick says that he has a friend in the bureau, and that friend told him that someone on the inside is providing info.
Uh-oh.
And then Dix wonders if it's Eric. LOL.
Well, no, yeah. He has not been around Eric long enough to realize that there's nothing going on there.
Can't even get him coffee. Warren says it's not. Dix says bad things will happen to Warren or Eric if they are the snitch. There is ominous music. And I think it's important to remember, dear listener, that we know from episode 1 of this season that it is Warren himself who has turned informant.
Right.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for reminding me.
Yes. So that's the undercurrent here, right?
Sorry.
So after Dick leaves, Warren is having a shouting conversation in his office with one of his henchmen who, quote-unquote, wants out.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. Rebecca walks into the outer office, hears the shouting, and eavesdrops. She hears Warren tell his henchmen that he got Eric to sign the documents, quote, to protect us.
Oh, no.
He says... Eric is our own private little insurance policy. But Rebecca hears it all. Warren walks his henchmen out and is surprised to see Rebecca. While Warren finishes his goodbyes, Rebecca walks into Warren's office and snoops through the documents that have Eric's signature on them. She's gutsy.
Yeah.
Warren walks back in and catches her, but she says she was just looking for a lipstick that she thinks she left earlier.
I left the lipstick here.
Yeah.
In
this file folder.
Yeah.
I'm not sure Warren believes her, and I assume now he will have her killed. Later, Rebecca shows up at Eric's house. She's there to warn him and tell him to, quote, be smart and to listen to her. Unfortunately, only one of those things is possible for Eric. So he listens to her. She tells him that the document he signed is Warren's get-out-of-jail card. Eric says he has things under control.
No,
and Rebecca, who has a knack for timely references, replies that the captain of the Titanic had more control than Eric does.
Oh, God.
Eric says, do you like insulting me? And Rebecca says, yes, but that's beside the point.
I like that line. That was
too.
A great line.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Yeah, because you're an idiot.
Yeah. She tells Eric that Warren has set up his corporation with Eric as the sole officer.
What?
Wait, what? Eric isn't just the signatory on the checks. He's actually the president of Warren Saget Development.
Yeah, it's like some dummy corporation that's like... It's weird.
It's a lot more complicated than we were led to believe.
Yeah,
but
totally.
Eric even understood.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rebecca tells him he'd better wake up before it's too late. He responds by looking stupid.
She's like, wake up and smell the coffee! And he's like,
oh, coffee. That night, a dejected Eric is walking alone by the shipyard.
What a dumbass. This is how Warren kills you so easily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No
kidding. I guess, but he needs to keep him alive so that he can send him to jail.
Right.
Yeah. So it's... Yeah, I still wouldn't walk alone by the shipyard if I were Eric. A car starts following him.
Uh-oh.
Ominous music.
Oh, no.
He walks over to the car. Dick Turnbull rolls down the window and says menacingly, you and I need to have a talk.
Nope.
He tells him forcefully to get in.
Nope.
Eric does.
Dumbass.
And the car drives off.
You never get in the car.
Yeah.
It's like self-defense 101. Don't get in the car.
Don't get in the car.
Don't let anyone stuff you in the car. Don't get taken to a second location.
Yes.
That's where the violence happens.
Yes, it's right. So that's the end of our story for today.
Oh my God.
I can only assume that our next encounter with Eric will be when the ferry runs over his bloated corpse floating in the bay.
Googly-eyed.
Or Bob's fishing line gets tangled up on Eric's femur at the bottom of Pine Lake. At any rate, as Ariel says in The Tempest, full fathom five thy Eric lies, of his bones are coral made. Those are pearls that were his googly eyes. Nothing of him that doth fade, but doth suffer a sea change into something rich and strange. What do you think, aunties? Is Eric about to undergo a sea change?
Yeah! Oh my God.
Our Shakespearean listeners, Uncle Brian really is too good for all of us.
I just appreciate you Shakespeare fans.
Mamo, Auntie Chrissy,
yes,
Auntie Cheryl, all you Shakespeare people.
Hi, Mamo. All right, so Eric's in trouble. Eric's going to die.
Eric's going to die!
Eric's gonna die.
If we're lucky.
Yeah, right.
Oh, man.
Yeah. All right, let us leave behind both Shakespeare and crime drama. And steal ourselves for the genre of our C story, the after school special.
It so is.
If you think it's high time that Cedar Cove turns its attention to teen issues, then this is the plot for you.
Oh, God.
This one came out of freaking left field.
Nowhere.
Yeah, out of nowhere.
Nowhere.
Oh,
what the shit?
I know. So the entire episode opens with Olivia and Grace chatting and walking. Olivia invites Grace and Cowboy Cliff on a double date with her and Jack, but Grace says they can't. Cowboy Cliff is leaving for a PBRA event. For those of you who don't know, which I hope is everyone, PBRA stands for Pacific Bull Riding Association.
What?
At least it does on the show.
Whoa. Wow.
Yeah. And okay. While Cowboy Cliff has indeed retired from the professional circuit, he is participating in a champions event. He'll be riding a bull named Killjoy, because apparently calling the bull foreshadowing felt too obvious to the riders. I'm riding a bull named Foreshadowing. but luckily, this scintillating discussion of Cliff and bull riding is cut short as teen arsonist Allison stalks past them angrily, ignoring their greetings.
Oh, shit.
They chalk up her rudeness to teen angst.
Is she doing drugs now?
Ah, if only.
If only.
If only.
Yeah.
What is she doing?
You may remember Allison from previous episodes. Her parents got a divorce in season one, and later in that same season, she burned down the town's beloved gazebo just so she could feel something.
Oh my god.
No, wait, how did they actually burn down the pergola? Were they smoking?
I think she was starting fires in the trash can.
Yeah, because she was cold.
And she refused to go back home.
And then
her boyfriend's like, I know what I'll do. I'll make you a trash fire.
Yeah, no, and then Prison Lenny got in trouble for it.
Yeah, yep. Right. And then the boy ended up having to rebuild the gazebo. Yeah.
And then the boy said he did it,
which
wasn't true.
No.
And she never got caught for any of
that.
No, she didn't.
She got away with it, and now she's emboldened.
Uh-oh.
Criminally, I think.
What is she doing?
We'll see. Okay. So now she's back, and a bit later she's at Grace's house after school until her mom gets off work, because somehow this, 16-year-old high school girl can't be home alone.
Yeah, it was weird. What is she doing there?
Yeah. It doesn't make sense. And Grace is acting like a television grandma during this scene, and trying to get Allison to join her for appropriately feminine domestic chores, like helping in the kitchen.
And they're, making cupcakes or something.
Yeah.
Who gives a shit?
Yeah, Allison refuses, and Grace is surprised. She says, you used to love to help in the kitchen.
When she was six.
Okay, Grandma.
Yeah.
But Allison's cellie is blowing up with text messages, which seem to upset her.
Uh-oh.
Grace nosily asks if she's getting texts from quote-unquote Liam, the boy who likes her. But Allison says he doesn't like her anymore.
Uh-oh.
At this point in my notes, I wrote, quote, I honestly don't have time for this.
None of us do.
True.
Okay.
So true.
Then Cliff shows up in his big stupid truck at Grace's. She tells him she will join him at the rodeo after Rosie picks up Allison, because again, somehow this 16-year-old girl can't be left alone. Cliff mentions that Alex and her Daisy Dukes are also coming to the rodeo, where she'll be meeting up with her boyfriend.
Oh, yeah.
Darn it.
Alex has a boyfriend. Now Grace is finally happy. And she is. She's all smiley and happy. And he's like, oh, you're happy now. I wonder why. So stupid. Cut to the rodeo competition. Cliff is telling Alex that he's excited to share what he loves with Grace. Alex says Grace will love him even more when she sees him ride that bull.
You mean the one called Plot Twist?
Yes, the one called Plot Twist. Now, is there a bit of sexual tension in this moment? Am I wrong, aunties? I think there was.
Oh, there was something there. Oh, there was for sure something there.
Which made me mad, because I spent the whole previous episode being like, Grace, you're so stupid to think anything could be happening between these two.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, oh, damn it.
I know.
There is something that
is
there between these two. Oh, how gross. Then we're still at the rodeo. There's a giant American flag and lots of hooting and hollering. Alex's boyfriend, Hugh, appears.
Oh, is that his name?
I think so.
I never caught his name.
I thought it was Hugh.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was Hugh. And he is clearly no good because he has shaggy hair and sideburns.
He is really unattractive.
Yeah.
He's not a handsome man.
They're not well matched on attractiveness, right?
No.
He and Alex are not.
No.
Yeah. That doesn't make
sense. And he doesn't even appear to be the right age. Isn't he, doesn't he seem older?
Yeah, well,
I mean, who knows? She seems really young.
Yeah, maybe she likes older men, too.
Yeah, true.
It turns out that he and Cliff are competing against each other in the bull riding competition. There's a bunch of masculine posturing and a figurative, thank goodness, pissing contest in which Hugh suggests that Cliff is getting old.
Uh-oh.
But you know who's not old? Who? Teen Allison.
No!
Let's check back in with her, shall we?
Oh, boy.
Back at Grandma Grace's homestead, Allison continues to get a flurry of text alerts on her teen phone.
Teen phone.
Teen phone. Grandma Grace asks her to help her outside, probably to, like, weed or plant hollyhocks or something. But Allison suddenly says she has to go and rushes out the door. In her haste to leave, however, Alex has implausibly left her teen phone behind.
No teen does that.
No teen has ever done that.
Nope. No. Not when the phone was the cause of her wanting to have to go.
She puts it down and then runs off.
Yeah.
Gotta go.
No.
Nope. No. So when another text comes through, Grace looks at the screen. And what do you know, aunties? Allison is being text bullied.
No!
Bullied textually. Just like the local news tells us can happen to teens.
Oh, yeah. My God,
no. It says that on KION.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
6:30 News.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is your teen being bullied by its phone?
Right. You know, bullying takes all forms these days.
It's, phone
it's on the Instabook. It's on the Twittergram.
It's on the friend face.
It's on you face.
Maybe Jack should write an article about this.
Oh my God.
For the Seattle paper for his audience of millions.
He should do a listicle. He should. A listicle of all the ways to avoid cyberbullying.
Yes.
Jesus Christ.
Oh.
When you go to sleep at night, make sure to put a post-it over your phone.
Oh. So naturally, Grace takes the phone to show to Olivia.
Oh,
and
God.
Somehow, Allison has gone this long without noticing that she's missing her phone and without trying to get it back.
Uh-huh.
But anyway.
You would think she would have, like, taken maybe 4 steps out of the house and been
yes.
like, oh shit, I have to go back and get my phone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't make any sense. But anyway, Grace has continued her snooping and has discovered that the bullies have also posted a bunch of stuff online, which makes it, wait for it, cyberbullying.
Oh, shit.
Here it is.
Olivia and Grace look upset, no doubt pining for a simpler era, an era before cell phone service and the internet. So, you know, less than a year ago in Cedar Cove.
Remember 18 months ago when all the teens lived in peace?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Remember life before cell phones? We called it season one. Oh. So eventually, Allison shows up at Olivia's chambers to retrieve her phone. They tell her what they know, and she asks, am I in trouble? She isn't, but they tell her that whoever is doing this is in legal trouble. Allison is unimpressed. She says this is just how high school is, and that's happening because the guy who likes her is liked by the most popular girl in school. But then after Allison leaves, Olivia admits there actually isn't any legal trouble, unless Allison tells someone, which didn't she just do that?
Yeah, totally.
Or files an official complaint. Olivia says that, my hands are tied.
No, they aren't.
But, says Grace, mine aren't. Let's go back to the rodeo.
Did I do this? What?
No, go ahead. Yeah.
I don't... I just don't like it.
I don't like it either.
Continue. I wish that it actually were the phone being like... What's the kid's name again?
Allison.
Allison, you look so fat in those jeans, Allison. Are you really gonna eat that next muffin, Allison?
And it's just the phone.
The phone was cyberbullying.
Yeah.
The phone has come alive.
Yeah. Oh. No, it's actually Kayla.
Her name is Kayla.
Her name's Kayla.
Well, with a name like that,
right?
She sounds like a nightmare.
Yeah. Sorry, any Kaylas.
Sorry, Kayla.
Yeah, I know some really nice Kaylas.
I don't. Let's go back to the rodeo.
Yes.
As we all saw coming, Grace calls Cliff to say she won't make it to the rodeo to see him ride Killjoy. He's his usual understanding self, saying that Allison needs her. As he hangs up, he sees Shaggy Hughes speaking angrily to Alex. Then she walks away from him, crying.
Uh-oh.
So trouble in...
Paradise.
That relationship that we knew about for 15 minutes.
Yeah. Trouble in That Sammy Hagar music video.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally.
Oh my God. That's exactly what Alex is. Oh my God. That's good.
Yeah.
Later, back at Grace's, Allison storms in. She is furious that Grace went behind her back and talked to her mom and to the school. She says Grace just made things worse.
Oh, yeah.
Grace says that according to the most recent issue of Modern Maturity...
What?
She
read,
that, quote, cyberbullying is against the law. But Allison says the law won't be able to help her. She tells Grace to stay out of her life, and right there on the spot, she quits her job at the library. Then she burns down Grace's house. Well, okay, not that last part. But she is mad, and she's feeling betrayed, and somehow Grace did not see this coming.
She's like, I'm going to the park. I'm going to light some fires in a trash can.
Grace, you make me want to burn things. You're responsible. For anything I burn down. She's gonna burn the high school now.
Oh my gosh.
She should burn down the high school.
Yeah.
Allison needs to go all
do
out.
Do it, Allison, do it.
Allison needs to go like do full it. Heathers. Explode the school.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, the flames. Okay. That's the end of that story. B story.
That was the end of that story?
Yeah.
That means that there's more of this in the next episode?
Yes.
For the love of God.
I know.
I know.
No, that plot is... That plot is forsaken by God. Now it's time for our B story. Don't worry, it has several of our least favorite people in it.
Oh God, the best!
This story opens, as all good stories should, with Justine warily going through the mail. In it, there's a thin envelope from, quote, Washington Pacific University.
Oh. And weren't there, like, four other envelopes that just sort of look like handwritten letters addressed to Olivia Lockhart, and they all look sort of the same, like the same, like the same intern just made this fake mail and was just wrote out her name four times. It's
and weird. In the life of this program, it's like one demented person living in a hospital who just keeps sending her the same letter over and over again. Like multiple copies of the same letter. All in the same day.
Yeah.
Maybe the ransom notes for Charlotte.
Olivia, I really need you to
pay
the kidnappers! Why haven't you done it yet?
I'm still in Florida.
I know.
Somewhere in the Everglades.
Being held hostage by two mice and an alligator on a paddle boat!
Please send the money!
Okay, sorry guys.
But also, yeah, so she gets an envelope from a university, but we cut away before she opens it. What could be in it?
Oh, I wonder.
Dear Justine, you're so cool.
That's all it says.
I hope so. Yes, let's hope so. All right, cut to Moon's, where Moon himself acknowledges a special guest sitting at the table on the patio, his own creator, Debbie Maycomber.
What?
She's sitting right there on the patio.
Totally...
And just in case you didn't recognize her, because I didn't,
yeah.
Moon very knowingly says, Debbie, what are you doing here?
And she's like, who, me? Debbie Maycomber?
Oh my God, I missed that.
I looked up her picture. It was her. Well, and you could also tell it's her because she's because the person who responded was a terrible actress.
Oh!
To which Debbie Maycomber, Moon's creator, says in this thin, pinched voice with a thin, pinched smile, oh man, you know I couldn't stay away from Cedar Cove that long. That's exactly how it goes.
Do it again.
Oh, Moon, you know I can't stay away from Cedar Cove that long.
Oh, my God.
What are you doing here? Right there. She's sitting. His creator is sitting right there, and he greets her.
Oh, my God.
I love it.
It was brilliant.
That's like the best scene of season two.
Yes, I agree.
I don't even remember it.
Yeah.
The director probably had them redo that like 10 different times, and it was all, and each time was worse than the one before.
They were all exactly the same.
Yeah. Her entree was not visible,
chimichangas.
As I recall. Mm. I couldn't tell.
No chimichangas. They're chocolate cake. No ice cream. No banana splits.
Oh. But let's bracket Debbie Makeover's thin, pinched acting for a moment and just marvel at the narrative metaphysics of this moment.
I know. This is
the
amazing.
Author of the series sitting at the restaurant she created. Indeed, the real world will not stop bleeding into Cedar Cove.
Amazing.
This episode.
That's amazing.
It's so cool.
Yeah. I love it.
Debbie, what are you doing here?
Oh. Anyway, as Debbie Makeover sits there.
Good for her. She deserves it.
She does.
She deserves to have her moment in the sun.
She does.
Yeah.
I'm reminded of that horrible moment in Twilight, the Twilight movie, where the author of that book is sitting there at
really?
The diner.
How did
yeah.
that happen?
Yes. But there's this moment when whoever the diner person, waiter, is, like, at the beginning of the scene, like, walks over and says, "Here's your vegetarian omelet, Stephanie." And puts it down in front of her. And then the scene happens around there. Yeah.
And then she's like, "Thanks!
Yeah.
Idiot!"
Yeah. So, yeah. Okay, so as Debbie Makeover sits there on the moon's patio enjoying her fish tacos, let's say.
Yeah, let's see
enjoying
fish tacos.
Her fish tacos, Justine pops in to meet Cecilia at Moon's.
Oh my god.
Cecilia says that it's official. She's pregnant.
Oh, for the love of God.
I know. For crying out loud.
Oddly, Justine reacts with happiness instead of dread.
How could
which
she
is what
be
I'm
happy?
Feeling.
Yeah.
And says they should celebrate.
Why?
Ugh.
Cecilia, to her credit, she looks a little bit less thrilled. Like, mm-hmm. she's not as celebratory. And then they decide to eat a whole cake.
You know what? Good. Cake,
yeah,
girl.
I mean, that's fine.
Food.
I'm all for that. Yeah.
A whole cake, sure.
Yeah. Cut to Luke writing in his journal on the beach.
Oh, no, you've got to be kidding me.
Well,
yeah.
But just when you, the snarky viewer, Auntie said, want to refuse this abrupt change in his character, he shows you and Justine the contents of said journal.
Oh, my God.
And it turns out that all he has written is, quote, "I hate this."
Oh, my God.
I don't disagree with him.
Yeah. Luke hates journaling.
I hate this, too.
Yeah.
I hate this, Teen Wolf! Oh.
It's so hard to hold a pencil with my paws! Don't you know that werewolves don't have thumbs?
Oh! Oh.
It's just like sticking out between his paw heads. Keeps slipping out.
He's just holding the pencil between his two paws.
I hate
like a board.
This.
I hate this.
Oh, but Justine isn't there to talk journal. She's there to come clean.
Oh my
she admits
God.
That she likes him, but says she can only be his friend. He asks if it's
this
about
is so
Seth
dumb.
Too. She says it's also about Luke being in therapy and how she's worried about messing up his recovery. Luke says he just got dumped by someone he's not dating and that he can't believe she's using his PTSD as an excuse.
Really? I can.
Yeah,
I mean, he does have a point that they're like not even seeing each other and she is like dumping him, kind of.
Yeah.
It's weird.
It is weird.
Well, I think that she's just rejecting him,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, I mean, he
yeah,
has
like
propositioned her, right, for a relationship. Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah, it's not being dumped. It's, it's being turned down,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's being
rejected.
Yeah, I guess.
I hate this!
I just want to be friends!
I hate that, too. cut away. Justine and Cecilia are walking and talking again, but this time not in the forest, so that's progress.
God, Cecilia is such a bad influence on Justine.
She is. Justine says Cecilia has to tell Ian about the baby. Cecilia says she will when he gets back, assuming nothing goes wrong with the pregnancy. Then she says she feels like a cliche because she's pregnant and eating ice cream. Justine reminds her that she also somehow ate a chocolate cake and four chili dogs. I am skeptical of this.
Yeah.
She did not eat four chili dogs.
And a chocolate cake? No.
I mean, come on.
That did not happen.
What is with the show's obsession with, like, oh my God, something must
with
be
with super
like,
skinny...
Hormonally wrong with me.
Yeah, with am super skinny women eating a lot of food. Yeah, it is obsessed.
Oh, I don't know.
Cecilia then asks Justine for a favor. She needs her to go with Luke to a big Navy benefit, where Luke is the guest of honor. And then, in what I would like to think is a throwback, a callback to the Bachelor auction in season one, Cecilia clinches Justine's participation by saying that it's for a good cause.
It's for a good cause!
Catchphrase!
You can get anyone to do anything if it's for a good cause.
Oh my God.
Oh, I love it. In the interim, Cecilia and Luke meet up. She tells him she's pregnant, so Justine is going to go to the benefit with him. She says that Justine is in love with him and that they should just be friends right now. He says, Roger that.
What?
Wow, what an important scene that
was. Has somebody given up on life?
Roger that.
Roger that. Okay.
What the shit?
That felt useful. All right, it's finally benefit night, which I guess is taking place the same day because this show always feels like it's taking place on the same day. Anyway, Luke shows up in his dress whites at Justine's. He looks pretty good.
He looks pretty good. Yeah. He looks really good.
He looks super good.
But, like, one of my... you may already have a comment on this. I hope I'm not jumping the gun, but...
Do it.
One of my problems with him and his dress whites that he is constantly carrying the hat around.
Oh.
And I get why he would be carrying the hat, like, to and from the event, or wearing the hat, like, from the car to the event, or whatever. But why does he have to bring the hat into the house to pick up Justine? Why is it not in the backseat of the car?
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
No, that doesn't make
any
sense.
Maybe it's attached to his wrist with a cord, so he doesn't lose it.
Oh, probably.
Like, I've lost too many of these, and my CO says I have to...
Yeah. And so it's like when you're a little kid, and you have, like, the string that goes through your jacket that connects your mittens.
Yeah. Could be.
Yeah.
You lost your hat, now you can't have any pie. You lost your hat, silly kittens. Okay, so, he looks good in his dress whites. Justine is in a red dress. Do you want to describe it?
Yeah, it's so basic.
Yeah.
Okay, so it has a jewel, like a jewel collar, uh-huh. like rhinestones around the neck.
Uh-huh.
Sleeveless.
Rhinestone collar.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and then it's just like a fit and flare. Like, it goes to the waist, and then it just kind of goes out to the knees. It's kind of a hot pink.
Yeah, it's red. Not exactly red. It's a pinky red.
It looks...
Yeah.
So it's like a coral red? It looks like something Grace should be wearing.
Yeah.
It's not... The coral very it's not exposed. Age appropriate.
It's weird.
It doesn't look like... It's either for like a 6-year-old or like a 60-year-old.
Yes.
It's not right for her age. It's not right for a formal. Like, she should be wearing something long and elegant.
Yeah, not
she should. You're right. For a benefit dinner
for
adults.
Dinner and
you're right.
Formal.
That's like a badly chosen prom dress.
It is. It's not correct.
You're right.
She should be wearing something much more sophisticated.
Her wardrobe is a disaster.
Well, this is a costume design fail.
Yes.
Yeah. I feel like she needed... It's just not a good look for her. It's like zero sex appeal, too. I mean, she looks like a flower girl.
Yes.
It's not a good look at all.
Right.
I don't get it.
Yeah, he
Even
looks good.
Even the hair.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's like this half bun with tendrils.
Ew. Oh.
It's like, what?
No.
So weird. I think her... Well, I don't know if this is the time to talk about it or not, but I just feel like her wardrobe has been all over the place this season.
Like, maybe every episode is a different, like...
The preppy boho thing is over.
Yep.
And I feel like it's indicative that the show just really doesn't know who she is. Like, she just has no center.
It's true.
Like, the
center cannot hold.
The center cannot hold.
Things fall apart. Her wardrobe. Chaos has been loosed upon her wardrobe.
Yeah.
Yes. So he looks great. She looks weird. But they're both attracted to each other.
Oddly.
And then they make up from their earlier fight. He asks if they can just go to the thing, the benefit, and not talk about anything important, i.e. them set to PTSD, therapy, etc. I think that's a fantastic idea, that's and fair. I wish they could make that agreement permanent.
Yeah.
like, let's just stick with that.
Yeah, let's none of us hear about that ever again. Yeah.
We don't get to see the benefit, of course, because I guess that would mean hiring a bunch of extras and putting them in dress whites, and nobody
It'd
wanted
be too
to do
expensive
that.
And, yeah.
But we do see Justine and Luke show up after the benefit at Moon's. Why? I don't know. There's never a good reason for anything.
It feels so prom. Right?
Yeah,
like after
it's
prom,
super prom,
you go to Denny's and get fries.
Or the Peach Pit, yeah.
Or the Peach Pit. Yes, totally. That's exactly what you would do.
Yeah. Pop's Chocolate Shop.
Get a free burger.
Yeah.
Get a free burger from Nat.
Because Nat never charges anyone anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they go to Moon's, they flirt and stuff. Cut to Luke walking Justine to the door back at her mom's house. She thanks him for the evening and says she forgot what real fun was like.
Real fun?
Yep, like
as
they just
to
had.
What?
Mm-hmm.
Fake fun.
Fake fun, yeah. And then she tells him that she got into grad school and
Yay!
That he's the first to know.
Wow. She didn't tell her mom.
No.
Or the mice.
Or the mice. Or Seth,
yeah.
too.
Well. So then she invites Luke in for coffee,
okay.
and I'm thinking some heavy petting. It's like prom night. But guess who's just standing there inside
the
house?
Cheese!
Human block of cheese.
Yeah!
Seth 2.
Amazing.
And scene. He's in the house!
How'd he get in?
I don't know.
The emergency key.
Yeah.
No one ever locks their doors in Cedar Cove.
It's true.
What
and so he's just
though.
Standing there waiting for her.
Yeah.
Be in the house.
He didn't call, he didn't email, he just showed up, and then he just sat inside Olivia's house waiting.
That's so Seth, too.
Right? He is uncommunicative.
Yes, he is. That's
Dang.
True.
It's true. That's
There's
a good
no,
point.
Yeah, no internet
it's
on the boat.
Very
no
Seth, too.
Yeah.
There's no what?
Internet on the boat, right?
Right, there's no internet in Alaska.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So
it's all the fish.
So,
they get in the way.
So I think something bad will happen with this in the finale. So, good. All right. A story. Here's our A story. What we might call the dissolution of Jack Griffith.
Dang.
Yeah. As this episode opens, Olivia is telling Grace that she's worried about Jack. The new job has him working around the clock. She thinks it's too intense. And well, may she be worried, dear listener, because as you recall, our last episode saw our hero Jack become secretly reacquainted with Comrade Vodka.
He was drinking it, dear listener.
Yeah, he was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't a homosexual relationship.
He wasn't bathing in
it
or anything.
No, he was drinking it,
was drinking it, yeah, out of a glass.
Yeah. So later they meet up. Jack tells Olivia that he had a terrible night of writer's block, but that he finally started writing at 2 a.m. What he doesn't mention is the bottle of Stoli that made that happen.
Dang.
Olivia asks if the job is too much for him, and he says he feels alive again.
I feel alive! I feel it coursing through my veins!
Yes, exactly. That's what he said. Quote, "This is what the writing life is like," he says. Which is true, I guess, in the sense that it's really only possible to do well if you're drunk.
Mm-hmm.
He says he has to go to Seattle again for the day, and they agree to dinner, but Olivia looks upset.
Mm-hmm.
Cut to Jack in Seattle. He breaks the news to his momentary second wife, Jerry, that his job is now permanent. She says they should celebrate. They go to a bar, he orders a beer,
and
he tells her, "You were right, I can handle drinking in moderation."
What?
And then he asks if she's going to give him a lecture about that, apparently forgetting that she's the one who sent him the bottle of vodka in the first place.
And who somehow suggested that moderate drinking was going to be totally fine.
Yes, so lecture me
and that moderate
on that thing that you told me I should do.
Moderate drinking is not 2 a.m. solo drinking.
No, it's not, is it?
Typewriter.
No, that's not.
Nope.
How it should be done.
No.
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 So after she refuses to scold him for drinking because, like we all remember, she wanted this, he says his column is now going to be featured in the Sunday edition.
Holy moly.
Why? Because newspapers have died, I guess.
Wait, what? Okay.
Yeah, they toast and drink. Later, Jack tells Jerry he's been thinking of getting a place in Seattle.
Oh, Jesus.
Jerry asks if he and Olivia broke up. He says the apartment would just be for him, not for Olivia.
It would just be for me and my bottles of alcohol.
They agree that it makes logistical sense for him to have a Seattle sex apartment.
What the fuck?
But Jerry wonders, will he tell Olivia? He looks guilty, and Jerry needles him, quote, "For a man who never wanted to get married again, you seem pretty married."
She's like
the worst.
She stirs the pot.
Yeah. Man. And then she says, "Personally, I wouldn't tell the little lady if I were you."
She's all right. She's all right. It's like the Eric Clapton song that I can't get stuck out of my head now.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think at this point, Jerry should just be wearing a devil costume and sitting on Jack's stool. I mean, Jerry isn't even like a character anymore. She's like the fucking death drive. Like, yeah. she's just trying to destroy everything.
Something that occurred to me was that maybe what you just said is actually true. Like, maybe Jerry doesn't actually exist. Like, yeah. Maybe,
oh my gosh.
Maybe she's a figment of Jack's imagination.
She's like Tyler Durden.
Exactly, she's Tyler Durden. Sorry, spoiler for like
spoiler
a 20-year-old
for
movie.
Some other movie.
Yeah, but like, but right, like maybe she's like
real.
These delusions of grandeur. Like, yeah. Oh, you're gonna have a white audience. You're gonna drink again. You're gonna get an apartment in Seattle.
You deserve a Seattle secret Seattle sex apartment.
Yeah, and he's just meanwhile walking down Seattle eating chili dogs by himself.
Oh my gosh, that's exactly. The imaginary Jerry.
Toasting his beer with
the imagine Jerry.
Yes!
Imagine
Jerry! Oh!
No, guys, I think she is actually real, but
real.
I think that's a little too sophisticated
awesome.
For Cedar Cove. But,
wouldn't that
you know.
Be great?
That
but wasn't cool. there. Wait, what was. What, in the 90s, there was a soap opera where one of the women characters loses her mind and then has a relationship with a stuffed animal. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
No.
And she talks to the stuffed animal, and the stuffed animal talks back. But because it's a soap opera with a low budget, it's just like her and like a stuffed animal, like going.
Oh my god!
No.
After this episode, we're gonna do some research.
Yeah, we're gonna define this
because I want to live.
I really want Jerry to be a figment of his imagination.
Because
she's so bad and so crazy.
She is so bad and so crazy.
What the shit?
And she has like this easy breezy style and her like long necklaces and
so weird
over her shoulders.
She's a woman named Jerry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so
weird.
Why
don't you drive the car into oncoming traffic? It'll be awesome. You can handle it.
You have it under control.
Yeah.
Go ahead, buy that gun.
Yeah. That's who she is.
Meanwhile, Jack is like submitting his weekly column to the Seattle Courier, and they're like, who the fuck is this? Why does
this guy keep emailing us?
To like the help at Seattle. The IT department keeps getting these emails. This rando. They're like, what do we do with these?
I don't know.
Oh my gosh. That's so good.
He's sending them from his crazy apartment full of guns, cocaine, amazing amounts of alcohol.
Oh my god, that's good.
This is so funny.
It's possible, guys.
It is.
It's possible.
Okay, so back in the cove, D.A. Tony brings lunch to Olivia while she's sitting on her thinking bench.
Oh my god.
He's buttering her up because they need a new night court judge.
Night court!
In Cooperton.
Nice.
Would she be interested?
No, that sounds awful.
She says she's thinking about scaling back her professional judging and spending more time on her amateur judging with Jack in Seattle. The DA says she wouldn't have done that a year ago. But she says she wasn't in love a year ago. This seems like a big deal for her, but all I can picture...
With a user, boozer, and a loser, let me tell you.
All I can picture is Judge Olivia on the bench in Cooperton, bantering with John Larroquette, Marky Post, and Marsha Warfield.
I know, me too!
And if you get that reference, dear listener, I pity you.
Night Court was a good show.
It was a good show.
It was. I want Olivia on Night Court. Oh, yeah. That's awesome. Later. Also, what the hell is going on in Cooperton?
Yeah, they need a
Night
always,
Court. They yeah. need Night Court and Vet Court and
everything's yeah. in Cooperton.
Yeah.
I think I'm starting got to issues. Think Cooperton's kind of a big deal.
I guess.
Well, careful, the next thing you know, Jerry and Jack are gonna end up in Cooperton.
Yeah.
Breaking some story.
With a love shack.
Yeah. Oh, alright. So later, Jack pops back off the ferry in Cedar Cove.
Uh-oh.
Shelley and Adele are there on the dock. It turns out they missed the ferry back in our D story. Oh, and they've been stranded there ever since.
Oh, shit. All day long.
Are you kidding? No, I'm serious. Shelley tells him that she and Eric broke up and that it was a lie when she told Eric she had met someone. She says she told Eric that so he would let her go. Quote, "He's bound to me by commitment, not love," she says. Wisely, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
He's bound to me by dumbassery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even though they've broken up, though, she says Eric can still see Adele whenever. Jack asks if he can, too. And she says, yes, but only when you're not drinking.
Oh! Oh!
Jack is shocked. But she says the smell is familiar to her. The breath mints and the beer. Jack protests, but he is so busted.
Mm-hmm.
Shelley says, I don't want you to lie to me.
Mm-hmm.
She says he needs to get himself together because she and Eric and Adele Dead Jordan need him. Jack looks mildly upset, but not as upset as he should be, I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think he's just in shock, I guess.
Yeah.
Or
Jerry's like, push her off the dock.
Yeah.
Then no one will know.
She caught the ferry back to Seattle.
That's right.
That's right, true. Jack? He's like, yeah, Jerry, yeah.
So, back at Jack's place, Olivia shows up unannounced. He refuses to kiss her and puts his hand over his mouth to hide his minty beer breath.
Uh-oh.
He covers by saying that he thinks he caught a cold.
No.
Then he says he has too much work to do on his imaginary column. And that they should catch up later. Maybe for dinner. Later that evening, he's arranging flowers for Olivia. I don't know why. She kisses him.
Uh-oh.
Even if he has the cold, she says. Then they make out. She says she wants to go to Seattle with him. Wants to get an apartment together there. Then they can spend 3-day weekends together. I think it's time I put us before everyone else, she says. But Jack is appalled. And he looks it. Olivia asks, do you not want me in Seattle? Jack does not answer quickly enough. Her face falls. Credits.
Oh!
Snap.
Sorry, Olivia.
He's got the bottle now.
Yep.
Yeah.
And Jerry.
And Jerry. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And millions of readers.
Millions.
Millions of readers.
What do we do with
every
these?
Sunday? Oh,
every Sunday. All right.
What
so,
do you need Olivia for?
It's true.
Yeah.
Five things. Because the line that demarcates our reality from Cedar Cove continues to erode, I think we should try to alter Peggy's ongoing plot. I think we can all agree that Colin needs to die, so let's help Peggy and Inspector Roy Sideburns PI come up with a plan to kill Colin and get away with it. What could they do, aunties? What are five good ways to kill Colin? And I think if we need Moon or Bob's help with the plan, I think we could count on them.
Yeah.
So, how do we kill him?
Yeah, I think that Moon could poison him.
Ah.
Yeah, just put some arsenic in the chimichangas.
Yes.
I think we just need to sick Jerry on him.
Oh!
Like, convince Jerry to convince Jack.
Yeah.
To, you know, do something.
I think Bob could take him out fishing.
Yeah.
Like, on a sort of choppy day, and just smack that bastard with an oar. And, like, dump him overboard. And, like,
Garrick
oh, we got hit by a swell.
With fishing wire.
Oh.
No, so gross.
Fishing line. That's gross.
That's a good one.
Now let's give Peggy some agency, though. How could Peggy tell him?
How could Peggy...
Yeah.
Well, I mean...
Arsenic in a pie.
Yep. Deadly pie.
Yeah.
A gardening accident.
Oh.
She needs to dig up a new garden bed.
Handy with a hoe.
He could just disappear. Like, no one's really missing him. Like, they could say he told us he was going back to Portland, and then he could be buried under,
yeah, it doesn't seem like anybody cares. Yeah,
yeah. A flower bed, at the time and tide.
Easy peasy.
Yeah, she could plant
something
over him.
She could, like, macrame the shit out of him.
Wait, what does that mean?
Yeah. I mean...
She could turn him into, like, a big statue covered in macrame.
Oh, yeah.
And then put him up in the living room where no one will ever know that it's a human being behind all that macrame.
Yeah, okay. I can't top that, so I think we're done. All right.
Yeah, I think we're done. Yep. Yeah, that's awesome. All right, well... that's our recap. Next time on No Helmet Required, we'll be discussing the finale of season 2, episode 12. Farewell, listeners. We advise you to go through life with a crooked smile and a knowing gaze. Please stay roughly within the law and use your down-home common sense.
Yay!